Tonight we want to continue our study of Christ. We want to talk about us too. We want to talk about being the aroma of Christ. The scripture that was read will be our text that we'll look at tonight. As we begin, I want to just remind us again, as we talked about what a Christian has to know. And there are a lot of things that a Christian needs to know in order to know how to live the Christian life. But first and foremost, a Christian has to know Jesus Christ. We can know all sorts of morals and all sorts of rules of living. We can know all sorts of doctrines and all sorts of other things. But if we don't know Jesus Christ, we can't be a Christian. And what does a Christian have to teach? We talked about last week. Well, we have to teach a lot of different things. There are many teachings that Christ left for us and that the apostles passed on to us. Very important things. But first and foremost, we have to teach Christ. He is at the center of all of those teachings. And any of those teachings, without Him, become meaningless. They become useless. They become just another way for man to try to save himself through some sort of set of rules, like those Pharisees were trying to do that Jesus confronted on many occasions, like many outside the religious world try to do by just saying, well, I'm a good person, I do these good things, I don't do these bad things, and so surely God wouldn't be angry at me. And that's what it becomes if we take Christ out. We must teach Christ first. Without Him, we're doomed. But tonight we want to focus our attention on what must the Christian be? What do we have to be? If we're going to be Christians, what is a Christian in essence? And as we look at that, and as we consider the passage that was read a moment ago, and we'll look at that in more detail a little later, but we realize, of course, that just like a Christian has to know a lot of things, and just like a Christian has to teach a lot of things, a Christian needs to be a lot of different things in many ways. We certainly need to be servants. We need to be members of a local congregation and help that church. We need to be evangelistic and out there sharing the good news of the gospel with others. We need to be a disciple, which a disciple is one of those words that we talked about this morning in class where it's a church word, but we don't always necessarily understand exactly what that means. A disciple simply is one who learns from another. So if we're going to be a disciple of Christ, we're going to be one who learns from Him. And so we have to be all of those things, certainly. But first and foremost, we have to be like Christ. We have to become like Christ. And that, of course, will help these other things to fall into place. If we live a pure, upright, uncontaminated life, doing all of the right things, and yet we may still not have the attitude of Christ, the mind of Christ, we could be doing all the right things, we could be practicing all the right worship, but we might not have the right spirit about us. So first and foremost, we have to get that essence of what Christianity is, which is Christ. We have to be like Him, inside and out. And as we become more like Him, that's going to show in the way that we speak, in the way that we act, the things that we think. We'll have more control over even our minds and what our very thoughts are, because we will want to bring them into line with thinking like Christ would think. There was a very popular thing probably 20 years ago, What Would Jesus Do? A book came out by that title, a fictional book, but boy, it really got people that, what would Jesus do? Well, the problem is, if we don't know who Jesus is, we wouldn't know what He would do. And so there were a lot of people who were running around with little bracelets and necklaces and shirts and everything else with the question, what would Jesus do? But they didn't know the answer because they had not studied his word to see what he did do, to help them know what he would do in their circumstance. Now certainly we live in a very different world than the one that Jesus walked around in first century Galilee. But as much as the world has changed, what Christ wants us to be has not changed. To be like him. Everything else is going to flow from that center. Paul says that the one thing which he is willing to sacrifice all else for is knowing Jesus Christ. We talked about in our class this morning, his desire when he was in Corinth, and we're looking in the book of Corinthians again tonight, his desire there to know nothing else except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And if we had that as our focus, now of course we talked then about how much that includes. That's not limited to just the name Jesus and while he died. But his crucifixion also would carry with it the teachings about his burial and his resurrection and the prophecies that led up to that crucifixion and the story of Jesus, preaching Jesus, teaching Jesus, sharing who Jesus is, carries with it all the prophecies about him. It carries with it the idea that Christ existed with God in the Godhead with the Father before the world was created and that all things were created. There's so much. His life here on this earth, his birth, his childhood, his ministry where he performed miracles and taught parables and all of those different things. And that's all included in knowing Christ. And the more we know him, the easier it is for us to become Christ-like. And as we become Christ-like, we will see the troubles of the world around us fade in significance because our focus has been moved and been changed. When we are Christ-like, we will develop the capabilities of a disciple that lead us to be committed and obedient, that will allow us to live that moral life, that will allow us to teach the right things, that will allow us to share with others what we know about Jesus. All of those will come as we become more like Christ. We are the aroma of Christ, Paul says. Here in 2 Corinthians. Now, I'll give a little bit background about the Corinthian church and this being the aroma of Christ. Paul spent 18 months in Corinth on his second missionary journey. And initially, he didn't really have a whole lot of success there. It didn't seem like people were just jumping at the chance to become Christians. Of course, that's not terribly surprising given the city's background and the kinds of people that lived there and the idolatry of the city, the immorality of the city, the Gentile nature of the city. They didn't know about God. They didn't know about the Bible in the first place. So they had a lot to learn. But then he has a vision in Acts chapter 18 and verses 9 and 10. And in that vision, the Lord comes to him and says, "Don't be afraid. Keep on preaching. Don't be silent. I'm with you, and no one's going to attack you or harm you. I have many people in this city." And so Paul stayed there then for 18 months, and he taught. Now there were a lot of hardships in Corinth as well, but he survived those. After being there for those 18 months, he moved on. That was the nature of missionary work. He moved on to Ephesus, and he stayed there for 3 years. At some point along the way there, he receives a letter from Chloe's household that the Corinthian church is having some problems. There's division in the church. There's immorality in the church. They're suing each other. There are just all kinds of problems going on. He receives another letter apparently, seemingly a different letter, not the same one, but possibly connected, that contains some questions that they have about some things that have come up since he left that maybe he hadn't covered thoroughly enough, or maybe they'd forgotten or what have you. But they have some questions. They were struggling with the teachings about marriage and divorce. They were torn about this issue of where does the conscience stop and how much can I bind on another and these kind of things. They were abusing the worship service, and the Lord's Supper in particular was a serious problem that they had. They were abusing their spiritual gifts that they had, the miraculous gifts. They were abusing those and misusing those. And there were even some there that were teaching that there was not even a resurrection coming. And so he attempts to deal with this situation. And of the two letters that we have of his, and it's possible that he wrote another letter that was not saved and recorded in the scriptures for us, but at least these two that we have. In 1 Corinthians, he goes to answer those questions and the problems. And if you read 1 Corinthians, you see it's just a list of, okay, here you got this problem, here's the answer to that, and so forth. And then he sends Titus to them to see how the Corinthian church is going to respond, to see if they're going to answer what he taught them in that first letter. Well, later on then, he meets Titus in Macedonia and he writes 2 Corinthians. And the indication from Titus has been that for the most part, things have gotten better. They straightened it out. You know, sometimes people point to the 1 Corinthian letter and they say, well, see, they got all those problems. Churches are going to have all sorts of problems. Well, yes, sometimes churches have all sorts of problems. When they have all sorts of problems, they need to be taught the correct way to handle those problems, and then they need to correct it. So if a church for decade after decade continues to have the same problems over and over, that church isn't growing like it should. Now, whether that's a failure of the teaching or the learning side of that, I don't know. It could be either or both. But the fact is, the church in Corinth, when they got that letter, and it was a blistering letter, he says, I'm not praising you about these things. You've got this problem and you've got that problem, and I can't believe some of you are teaching this nonsense. It just goes on and on with them. When they got that letter, they took it to heart and they said, we're going to fix these things. One of the things involved the sexual immorality with the man who had his father's wife. And they apparently, he told them how to handle that. He said, you know, you need to withdraw from that fellow. Don't even eat with somebody that's living like that and calling himself a brother. He said, if people out there in the world, we know they're going to live like that. But as Christians, we don't live like that. So he learns from Titus that apparently they had done well. They had repented of the wrongdoing, and they were straightening things out. Now, understand, of course, the church in Corinth is still not a perfect church. They're still going to continue to have some problems. But Paul writes a second letter to confirm for them that he still loves them, he still cares about them, that they're still belonging to Christ. But he also wants to reaffirm for them what Christianity is all about. And there are several things that are in the second letter. A lot of people believe that some of the second letter, especially chapter 2, is going to hearken back to that situation of the discipline with that man who had his father's wife from 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And that he's saying that they went so far to the point that once the man even repented and tried to come back and do right, they were still punishing him. And he said, wait, well, you know, okay, now the punishment worked, the discipline worked. Now welcome him back and take him back in once he's gotten things straight. So they were really eager to follow what Paul had to teach. And Paul writes the second letter, again, to encourage them further and to, of course, remind them who they're supposed to be. We're the aroma of Christ. And we see that there in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Now, we think about the Corinthian church. What was it known for? Well, it's known for the bad, for the most part. It's known for the problems. If you go around to people who know about the Bible and you mention the Corinthian church, why, they're going to think about the bad things that were in that first letter. They may not necessarily think about how that church grew and overcame some of those problems like they did before Paul writes this second one. But as we look at this section in verse 14, he's going to explain this to him. Now, the problem that the Corinthians had was, of course, their reputation had not always been favorable. They had not always been being the aroma of Christ that they should have been. And so the relationship between who they were and who they were supposed to be, the smell that they were actually giving off and the smell that they should have been giving off. Have you ever cooked something that was spoiled? And it doesn't smell right when it's cooking, does it? We can tell. We say, there's something wrong with that. Oh, I'm going to throw that out. We've had that on occasion with some hamburger meat, you know, and kind of get it out, and it kind of looks, you know, it doesn't look quite like I put it in the skillet and turn it on. And say, oh, yeah, that's there's something wrong with that. That's spoiled. We can do that with a jug of milk, you know. You open that jug of milk out, you know, you see, that expired yesterday. But maybe it's still good, right? Open that cap and, no, it's not any good anymore. We can smell a lot of times when something is wrong. There's a big relationship between the nature of something and the odor that it emits. Now, of course, some things will deceive you, like coffee. It smells really good. And I would think it would taste good, but then it tastes like somebody burnt something and poured it in a cup of water. But anyway, as my dad always said, I'm a Christian and I don't drink coffee. And somebody, are you saying Christians can't drink coffee? I didn't say that. I just said I'm a Christian and I don't drink coffee. You draw your own conclusions there. But as we look at 2 Corinthians 2 and verses 12 through 16, we see in verse 13 that Paul is very troubled. He couldn't ease his spirit because he hadn't found Titus, and he couldn't find out what was happening with the Corinthian church, and he was concerned about it. And so he says, you know, I had no relief in my spirit, or I had no peace of mind. I couldn't relax about this. But he starts then in verse 14 showing, even though he was still troubled by it until he could find Titus and get the report, he says, but God always leads us in victory, in triumph, in a triumphal procession, a big victory parade. In other words, you know, I may not, you know, I may have still been struggling with that, but I know God always knows what He's doing. God is always going to lead this victory. God is moving us in the direction of victory. That's what He wants for us. And if we're following along with Him, we're headed in the right direction. And that happens in spite of ourselves, in spite of our sins and shortcomings. He's still working on us to make us what we ought to be. That little song, we sing it with the kids sometimes, He's still working on me to make me what I ought to be. It took Him just a week to make the moon and the stars, the sun and the earth and Jupiter and Mars. But how loving and patient He must be, because He's still working on me. You know, it's kind of embarrassing for us to think how long and hard God's having to work on us when He created the whole thing in 7 days, 6 days, really. He rested that seventh one. So, you know, that's an amazing thing to think about. But God is using us to accomplish His ends. He's helping us to be the fragrance that He wants us to be and spread that fragrance everywhere. Verses 15 and 16, we are the sweet aroma, that sweet fragrance of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. So he explains, our smell is to be a smell of Jesus. Now, we're not talking, obviously, about the literal physical smell of Jesus. We don't know what He smelled like. I can imagine He was a sweaty man at times and smelled like a sweaty man. But that's not the smell that we're talking about. We're talking about the smell that we give off to God. That aroma that pleases God. But we don't just give that off to God. Again, something about the nature of who we are that tells what smell we're going to give off. As we become more like Jesus, then we're going to smell more like Him. We're going to give off the aroma more like Him. You know, we think about some of the disciples who, Peter and John particularly, would say they realized, they had never been to school, but they noticed they'd been with Jesus. The more time we spend with Jesus, the more like Him we become, the more people are going to notice that we're like Him. Because we're going to talk like Him and act like Him and love like Him. Maybe even correct like Him at times when that's necessary. But we want to notice two groups of people here also. We're this aroma to God, this sweet-smelling sacrifice to Him. But He's not the only one smelling that. There's someone else, two groups of someone else's, in fact, that are also smelling us. And those are those who are saved and those who are perishing. We'll take that in reverse order. To those who are perishing, we are the odor of death that brings death. We're a reminder to them that the way that they're living is not the proper way. We should be a reminder to them that they don't smell like Jesus. They ought to notice that we smell different. And it should be a conviction to them that are perishing in their sins, dead in their sins, that they need to have something change in their life or they're going to destruction. To those who are being saved, it should just be that much more, a sweet smell of life that brings life, that is encouraging. A conviction to those who are saved that, I want to smell more like that. Maybe I don't smell enough. Here's someone who really, really is like Christ. Really is reflecting Christ in their life. Really is giving off that sweet aroma. And I want to become more like that than I am right now. You know, the Corinthians hadn't always been careful to be the aroma of Christ that they should. But Paul insists to them, it's time you start smelling like that. It's time you start smelling like Christ. When we become Christ-like, we're going to produce a Christ-like aroma. And then we're going to be a fragrant offering to God that will be acceptable and pleasing to Him as well. And the Corinthian church was growing into that point. They had not been, but they hopefully would be. So as we draw toward the end, we want to ask ourselves the question, are we the aroma of Christ? We know we ought to be. We know what we are to do to become more Christ-like, to know Him better, to teach Him better. It's not enough just to live a good moral life, keep the rules, be a good citizen, and cry out, Lord, Lord. It's Christ-like people that God wants. Not good people or kind people or dedicated people even, but those that are like Christ. Now the thing is a Christ-like person going to be good? Well, sure. Isn't a Christ-like person going to be kind? Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that Christ-like person going to be moral and dedicated? Yeah. The problem is, without Christ, we can't do it on our own. Nicodemus was good, but he wasn't good enough. Saul was righteous after his own measurement of righteousness, but it wasn't enough. The rich young ruler, was dedicated to some things, but not enough. Cornelius, he was a good man, but he was good for nothing because he wasn't a follower of Christ. So as we think about it, who are we? Are we the people who have become so Christ-like that others around us start to smell that smell of Christ on us? You ever notice when you're around a certain smell? Maybe you're burning the sticks and leaves out in the yard or something, and you get that smoke all over you. Or maybe you've got a fire in the fireplace and that smoke, and you smell like that. Maybe it's you went into the gas station and you smell like the cigarette smoke. Maybe you were giving somebody a hug that was wearing perfume and you come away with their perfume on you and smell like them for a while. Maybe you just smell like bacon. That's a good smell. But whatever it is, you pick up those smells from the things you're around, and what you eat can affect the way you smell. All these things. Who are we? What do we smell like? Are we just picking up a little bit of a smell from transference? Or are we starting to actually be like Christ so that we are emitting that smell of Christ to the world? That's what we need to be doing. When people get a whiff of us, are they thinking about the man from Nazareth? Do we look like him? Do we walk like him and talk like him, smell like him? Who are we? Are we the aroma of Christ? Or when people smell us, do they smell, well, there's somebody, boy, they sure are self-righteous. Boy, they sure do look down on people who can't live up to their standards. They have a real disdain for people who sin in any way. Or do they get a whiff of humility and compassion? Do they get a smell of our Master when they smell us? What do we smell like to God? You know, the interesting thing that they always tell, and we always tell kids, and I know I was told as a kid, you probably were too, when it came to maybe you found some little animals, little wild animals, particularly birds in a nest, or maybe some little squirrels or something like that, and they always said, don't pick them up and handle them. Don't touch them. Because if you pick them up and you handle them, then your human smell will get on them, and then the mother will reject them and won't want anything to do with them because they'll smell like a human being's been around, and it'll scare the mother off. I'm not a scientist. I don't know how much truth there is to that statement, but it sure is one that's been around for many generations, I think. And maybe there's a lot of truth to that. But what do we smell like? Do we just smell like another human being? Do we smell like the world? How do we smell to God? Do we smell like His children? Do we smell like His sheep? How do we smell to each other? How do we smell to the community around us? I think probably one of the issues that we have here, just like everywhere else, is our smell isn't strong enough to reach all of the community. I've met a lot of people over the last month, new people that I had not met before, and we talked about, you know, I'm a preacher, and where do you preach, and where's that church, what's that church like, and what, they don't know. We haven't been getting out there spreading the aroma of Christ enough for them to know. And I know it's hard for us to meet everybody and that's out there. But we've got to get out there. We've got to be letting people see Christ in us and smell Christ in us. We can't afford to just smell good to human noses, though. We've got to smell good to God's nose. Because His is ultimately the one that determines what's the right smell and what's not. He's the expert sniffer. We must be sure that we smell like His Son Christ, so that he can consider us one of his own. And of course, we've got to be concerned not just about our personal aroma, but of our whole congregation. What is the aroma? What is the reputation? Just like the Corinthian church had a reputation, and it wasn't always a good one. What is our reputation? And what can we do to make that a better reputation, to make it a better smell to the community around us? We need to work on that as well. And then as we close, we just want to ask the question that Paul asks at the end of verse 16. Who is equal to this task? Now we might say, none of us are. We can't live up to that. Jesus was perfect. I'll never be like him. And it's true, on our own, we never could. We could never be like him. But we forget we don't have to do it alone. We can help each other, and Christ is there to help us. And he's promised that his Holy Spirit will give us strength in the inner man as well. We need to take advantage of those things and not just count on our own abilities to get us there, because it won't. If we're counting on ourselves, then the answer to who is equal to this task is no one. But if we realize we're not in it alone, then we can say like Paul, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And we can mean it. Who's equal to this task? Who's adequate for these things? Well, we can be if we'll allow God to work on us. If we'll allow him to transform us so that we stop smelling like ourselves, stop smelling like the world, and start smelling like Jesus Christ. If you're here this evening and you do not smell like Christ as you should, maybe you don't know him like you should, maybe you haven't been taught him like you should have been, maybe you haven't learned enough and need to learn more, maybe you've not become like him, maybe you haven't imitated him. But you know, even Christ, when he was on earth, he went to John to be baptized, and he said he needed to do that to fulfill all righteousness. Now he was a man, he had no sin to wash away, and yet he still said, I need to be baptized to fulfill righteousness, to proclaim that God's commands are worth obeying. If even Jesus needed to be baptized, why would people today think that they wouldn't need to be? We have sin to be washed away. Maybe you haven't done that and you need to do that. Maybe you need to become a child of God so you can start smelling more like him. Maybe you are a child of God in the sense that you have obeyed the gospel and that you've started walking that life, but maybe you are falling down in some areas. Maybe you've stopped growing like you should. Maybe you've just been happy, well, it's good enough. Well, good enough is not good enough. If you're here tonight and you have a need to respond for any reason, please come as we stand and sing.